I want to stick to wrestling. I thank the Ramones for writing that song after hearing our show. Thank you very much, guys. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. I am John McAdam. This is Stick to Wrestling. This is the only wicked good wrestling podcast out there. Give us 60 minutes and we'll give you a hype podcast. Sean, you and I have to talk. You have to tell us everything. No holding back. All the information. There are all kinds of rumors and innuendo going around that this Stick to Wrestling podcast has a Facebook group. Spill it. What's going on?
It most certainly does. It is the Stick to Wrestling Facebook group. It's a creative title. We like it. And we're there pretty much every day, both of us. I don't know if that's a selling point or not, but if it is, I'm assuming if you're here, it's a selling point. We were there most days, and any question, everything's free game as far as old school wrestling goes. I mean, even if we don't know, you're going to find somebody who does know. Pretty much, yeah. And everybody you pretty much hear who comes on the show is going to be there as well.
There you have it. So today we're going to get to a show that I've been wanting to do literally since October, November last year. I was going through my 1981 WWF stuff and kind of reorganizing it, and I got to rewatch a lot of it. And I'm like, okay, it's fresh in my head. Let's kick off 2019 with this. Well, we had all kinds of stuff come up between then and now, and we're just getting started on it. But and then we had more topical stuff come up, and well, when I say that, I want to bring on our special guest for the week, Steve Generali. Steve, how are you?
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for inviting me to the show and to participate. I love your show, and I love WWF, so this is great to be here.
Well, hey, we're great. We're so glad to have you. You started watching wrestling right around the same time I did. You said 1976.
That's correct.
Yeah, well,
I started watching. Actually, it was on Channel 9 at midnight, like most people. It was the setup for the Bruno and Parisi against Superstar and Koloff at MSG, and I was addicted from that moment. Bruno was the best by far, but I was really a heel fan. I love the heels. Other than Bruno, I love the heels, especially Superstar and Albano and Blassie, and so that's how I started. And kind of before we segue into 1981, I got to see Backlund wrestle in Binghamton, New York, where I'm from. And I got to see him defeat Stan Stasiak, Billy Graham, Luke Graham, Valentine, Ivan Koloff, Spiros Arion. So getting into 1981, which we will eventually do on this show, I was just dying to see someone beat Bob Backlund.
Oh, yeah, we're going to be talking about that, all right, because by the time 81 came around for me, I mean, I was like you. It sounds like we really got into it, like, at the exact same time, because it was spring of 76 when Strongbow came back, and it kind of, wrestling for me went from, okay, if it's on, I'll watch it, to I'm not doing anything until this is over. So, yeah, same exact time frame. Well, I wanted to talk about, before we get into 1981, Pedro Morales passed away a couple of weeks ago. Steve, do you have any, like, memories of Pedro? I mean, what did you think of him in general? We both kind of missed by about 3 years, him being WWF champion. But what were your thoughts on him in general?
Well, let me give you first a misconception that I had about Pedro Morales all these years, and I recently found out the truth. I always kind of assumed that after Bruno came back and won the title at the end of 73, I just kind of imagined that Pedro Morales probably hung around a little bit longer and then just vanished. And through the research I've done, I found that wasn't the case. He actually wrestled most of 74 in the WWF, and didn't work a full schedule, but he really worked the territory that year, mainly house shows. He even worked parts of 75 in the WWF, and even finished his final match before returning in 1980 was a Boston Garden show in December of 1975 against Killer Kowalski. But as far as a worker, I think the smart fans never really cared for Pedro. I know in the Observer they kind of crapped all over him over the years, but I think he's a much better worker than the people give him credit for, and I know Bret Hart, among others, is always sung his praises as being a very good worker in the ring and very versatile. And I'll pass it back to you guys.
No, that's fine, man. I mean, I personally, when Pedro was in the WWF, when he came back in 1980, I didn't like him because I was a kid and I liked the heels. Now, as time has gone on, I've grown to really appreciate Pedro Morales. I absolutely thought he should have been in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame a long time ago. And yeah, while we're talking about that, I mean, the Wrestling Observer, you know, their crowd in 81, 82, 83 didn't like the WWF at all. So Pedro was a big part of that. But I thought he was more than a solid number two behind Bob Backlund for a long time. I mean, he was a strong, the strongest number two I ever saw in the Backlund / Bruno era.
No, I agree with you. And his wars with Morocco especially were very memorable. I happened to see them at a small house show in Syracuse, New York in 1986. They were kind of the middle of the card by this point, but it was so interesting to see these two great legends and this great rivalry that they had at MSG now at a house show in Syracuse, New York. And they kind of did almost like a greatest hits version of their classic matches. It was probably only like a 10 or 12 minute match, but they still had a great chemistry with each other. And I'd say their rivalry had to be one of the greatest long-term rivalries in the history of the WWE.
Oh, I mean, they brought Pedro back at, I want to say, the beginning of 1985, and he came back to Madison Square Garden, and it was, he came to the ring like in his suit, you know, to wave to everybody and, hey, I'm back. And who's in the ring but Morocco getting ready to wrestle Sweet Hansen? So they kept that connection going for quite some time.
They really did. And they always, you know, Vince always kept Pedro strong, I think, right up to the end. I think even in 87, he lost to Savage via countout at MSG, if I remember correctly. But, you know, and his last official match was that old timers battle royal at the Meadowlands at the end of 87. But, a great career and definitely one of the founding fathers of the WWF.
Yeah, he will be missed. And like I said, I think he was, you know, long deserving of getting into, you know, what I consider the real Wrestling Hall of Fame, which is the Observer Hall of Fame. Sean, do you have any thoughts on Pedro Morales you'd like to share?
Actually, a couple. One, he was also a very big star in Los Angeles. He never did well down south, but in L.A., I believe he was the WWA World Champion in the 60s.
That is correct.
So he was a big star there. A quick question, Steve. Who was a bigger draw on average in Madison Square Garden? Was it Bruno or Pedro?
You know, I think if you went strictly by the numbers, Pedro probably because he had a smaller serving size. I think him and Superstar percentage-wise probably had the biggest percentage of sellouts. But, you know, Bruno and Backlund to a lesser degree, for being on top so long, it's amazing the longevity and the ability to draw, which kind of leads me in, Sean, to this point before we get into 1981. As 1980 ended, there were two MSG shows in December of 1980, one headlined by Bruno, where Bruno drew 20,000 fans against Sergeant Slaughter, and another show where Backlund beat Killer Khan, and he drew about 18,000 fans. So I'm not saying that Bruno was still outdrawing Backlund, but at least for that month, he certainly did.
The thing that amazes me is that I always thought that Pedro, I mean, didn't draw as well as, you know, he did okay. He drew well in Madison Square Garden. I mean, those were big houses he was drawing. They were always over 20,000.
Well, I think the complaint about Pedro was, I think people always said that, you know, MSG, he was gangbusters, but the other houses, or as Bruno would say, clubs, he didn't really do as well. I don't think he was huge in Philly and some of the other smaller markets. But MSG, yeah, he could have probably continued headlining there for a long, long time.
Yeah, that was the that was the story going around that Pedro, he did well at Madison Square Garden, but not as well everywhere else. And, you know, this isn't a knock to Morales, but Vince Sr. gave Bruno, I mean, just a record-breaking deal to get him back. I think it was 10% of the gross everywhere and a reduced schedule. And rumor has it, or myth has it, that Sam Muchnick called up Vince Sr. and yelled at him for giving Bruno such a sweet deal that he knew that the NWA champion would soon want. A couple of quick things. Steve, you mentioned that December 28th, 1980 show at Madison Square Garden. That was the last time that they had the New Japan guys all come in and have a big show with them. And secondly, and I apologize if I've said this too much, but I will never understand how when superstar Billy Graham was WWF champion, that they did not bring Pedro Morales in for a big run against him. It was just the most organic and logical thing they could have done. And I don't know why they didn't do it. It's crazy.
Yeah, they did have a match, as I'm sure you guys probably know. They had a match in Florida about that time when Billy was champion, and he went down to Florida a lot and defended his belt. I think he even defended against Morocco down there too. But yeah, you're absolutely right, John. That would have made perfect sense. That would have been probably a sellout with a felt form sold out too.
Oh, I am completely convinced. And yeah, just, you know, having the match against Pedro in Florida, I mean, it's just not the same thing as having a run up here where, you know, he could have done three matches with Graham in Madison Square Garden. There's no question in my mind.
You know, absolutely. And it's funny to look at Pedro's record book, because the years after he left the WWF and he went to like the AWA for a year and a half, and he went to Florida, other places, he was kind of middle of the card guy. He wasn't really main eventing that much, and he wasn't really undercard. But I wonder how it must have felt for him to return to the Garden in 80, where he was such a big player and he was really on top again. It must have been a good feeling for him.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember that when they brought him back, I was, you know, very happy to finally see this, you know, guy who was a huge star, one of, I think, only five guys at the time who ever held the WWF title. And, you know, I finally got to, he was the last one I got to see at that point. But So anyway, more kind of topical stuff. The WWE Network, about 14 days ago, dropped a match that, I mean, I had been dying to see for 40 years. It was the one-hour draw between Bob Backlund defending the WWF title against Greg Valentine. This was February, I think, 16th, 1979. So something I've been, you know, if you had to ask me before that match came out, you know, what's the number one match you'd want to see, that would have been in my top 10. Now, Steve, you have a unique perspective on this match, and I'm dying to hear this, because you saw it on USA Network shortly after the match happened, and you did not know the result coming in.
Right.
Is that right?
I believe so.
So
yes.
what were your thoughts, like, as the match was going on?
I mean, it was a great match. And I mean, Valentine at that time, I mean, I would say the new style worker, I mean, the WWF had, you know, all the old guys who had been there since the Bruno days. But after Patera, who was really the first, I'd say, new age performer, Valentine was probably the second new style performer who could really work in the ring, could really move in the ring. And, you know, comparing Backlund and Valentine, I mean, they could have been like, you know, separated at birth, because they were so, you know, well balanced and so evenly matched. And it's one of those matches where, you know, anyone could have won the match. I, you know, again, as a heel fan, I had to root for Valentine. But, you know, even as a kid or a teenager back then, I could tell that they were grooming Backlund for a long run. So I wasn't really surprised by the outcome. And as we keep watching these Backlund matches, you kind of see a formula that they're going to try to make him kind of like the next Bruno, as far as making him a long-term champ that just can't be beat.
And see, I love that kind of insight, because you took us back in time to what it was like being a WWF fan back in 1979. And I appreciate that. Sean, what did you think of the match?
This is an outstanding spot where I should bring up the Facebook page, because we had actually in-depth discussion about this very topic there. I did not love that match, and you can usually tell on a match you know is going to be a draw 10 minutes in. You're like, yeah, because they're working a draw. They're working a 60-minute match. The best way to do it is to do like 6 10-minute matches, you know, or 2 3 20-minute matches, something like that. But and so and that's why even having 2 out of 3 falls is perfect for it. But you can just tell they seemed out of sync. They, you know, I don't know. It just there was no flow to it.
You know what? It's okay. I mean, if everyone had the same opinion, this wouldn't be a very interesting place. I loved the match. Yesterday I sat down and made sure I had no distractions and just watched that match, and I loved it. No, it was not a, you know, anything that would look like something you'd see on Monday Night Raw or on a WWE pay-per-view. It's not
Go ahead. To be clear, I love a good hour draw. If done, it was like it was their first time. I like them together. I have seen them in better matches in 81. It's just right there. For some reason, they seemed a little out of sync to me. Maybe it's just because I've seen them in better. I was expecting more.
I went to the Boston Garden in 1981, and I saw Magnificent Morocco against Bob Backlund in a 1 hour draw, and it was really bad. And I knew, like you just said, 10 minutes into it, that they were going to a Broadway. And I also knew, obviously, I knew the result of this match coming in, and I tried to ask myself as I was watching it, like, okay, would you think this was going to a draw? And I would say if I didn't know the result, I would say I would probably be looking at it as a draw, maybe 50, 55 minutes in, saying, okay, if they haven't done a finish yet, obviously they're going to the 60 minutes. But they did a lot of great stuff in that match. I mean, they would have a move, there would be a counter for the move, there would be a counter for the counter, and then a counter for that one. I loved it. It was just, you know, great 70s chain wrestling.
And then hit the mat for 7 minutes.
but that was wrestling back then.
I didn't have to know, but if I see Flair back then, Flair would be on the map. He'd be doing stuff. These guys are just laying there, and then they come over.
I don't know about that.
It was.
I think you can have a headlock where they're working, and that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't know. Like I said, I love an hour match. In this case, it felt like it was their first match together. They just didn't. You know, that may be the issue. That, you know, it's an hour match for two guys who just, you know, weren't used to each other, maybe. I don't know.
Throw in, as far as I know, it was their first match, but I know it was Valentine's debut or non-television debut in the WWF for that run. But, Steve, we did a show, I think you might remember, where we talked about Meltzer star ratings, and I would give that match 4.25 stars. That's how much I liked it. And I also love the fact that after the match, after the bell had rung, Valentine put Backlund in the figure four, and Backlund couldn't get out. Skoland had to come up and hit Valentine with the belt. That kind of signaled to the fans, like, if this match went 5 more minutes, Backlund might have been in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll tell you guys a completely weird aside that is completely takes us into another vortex. Greg Valentine actually appeared in Binghamton that year at a house show against Chief J. Strongbow when they were having their major feud at the time. And mm-hmm. and the weirdest thing happened. It was a great match. It was a bloodbath where Valentine really busted Strongbow open. The next day in our local newspaper, which is the Press and Sun Bulletin, they printed this story, which, I mean, it'd be worth looking up for any of you enterprising guys who want to do the research. But a local writer for the Sun Bulletin newspaper told this long column story about Greg Valentine having difficulties in his marriage. And it was all about his romantic difficulties being on the road most of the year. It was so bizarre, but I wanted to take you guys off the beaten path with that story.
Oh, someone's got to find that for me. that sounds so 70s cool. I don't know
what's
so
make bizarre.
Of
it. It is.
Yet another reason to come to the Facebook page.
There you go.
I'm sure that article will be there by tomorrow.
Probably. Let's hope so.
I certainly hope so. But anyway, yeah, these guys have all kinds of problems on the road. But anyway, so yeah, we're finally getting into 1981. Sean, we're going to go with the Madison Square Garden results. I believe the first show they had was February 16th, I want to say.
Yep. If you remember the 1976 series we did, basically we're doing the same thing because all WWF booking at this time revolved around the Garden shows. So if you go through the Garden shows, you'll basically get an idea what the year was like. This time we're doing 1981. So first show is February 16th. We have 20,808 people, good crowd. And starting up, we have Killer Khan, Dom DiNucci. That's low on the card for Killer.
Well, you know what? Now I'm wondering if I have this show. Was this show broadcast on MSG Network?
Yeah, it says TV, so that has to have been, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like an odd opener for me. It kind of makes me question whether or not the website has the show in correct order. But well, I mean, yeah, that is kind of low on the card for Khan.
The great Yatsu, who I believe is from also would eventually be from Choshu's army a few years later, and I think it was the New Japan angle, the invasion angle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think he was a member of that, right?
Yeah, he was, and he was a regular in the WWF at this time. He was just he didn't get a big push, but I don't think he did a lot of jobs either. He was on TV a few times, and he was a regular on the road with the WWF for a little while.
Steve, tell me what you thought about Hulk Hogan right now, February 1981.
Well, Hulk Hogan had a very unique resemblance to a Philadelphia Flyer by the name of Norm Barnes. That stood out at the time. I was a big hockey fan. He looked just like Norm Barnes to me. But Hulk Hogan, you could tell, was going somewhere. We actually saw him in Binghamton in 1980. It was a show headlined by Bob Backlund against Larry Zbysko, and Zbysko won the match. And me and my friends were rooting Zbysko on, and we practically got killed by the fans near us. But the match between Andre and Hogan was one of the best Andre matches we'd ever seen. We'd seen him before, Andre, and the matches were never really that competitive. They were more like jokes where he would just manhandle his opponents. But Hogan was a legitimate contender, and you could tell he was going places. And the thing that you're going to be surprised about as we go through these results, you are going to see that he lost via pin to Tony Atlas. And, you know, Tony Atlas in 1981, he really stands out because he not only beats Hogan in three or four of the biggest WWF cities, he also ends up teaming with SD Jones in a team that almost would go on to win the tag team championships that year, but it just never happened.
John, how much longer was Hogan going to be there? I actually thought he was gone.
Yeah, Hogan he showed up right around Thanksgiving 1979, and he had the longest run a heel had that I'd ever seen, you know, not including guys like Baron McLuhan and Stan Stasiak, who were like at the bottom of the card by the time they left. He was in the WWF, like I said, November 79, and he left like May of 1981. That was like unheard of back then. Most of the heels did like 7 or 8 months.
Okay, this is going to be very quick. Whoever decided to give the Hangman versus Frank Savage 11 flipping minutes should be put on stocks on 59th Street. But that's aside the point. Why?
Well, Frank Savage was a guy who got – you know what? He got a tiny little bit of a push as an undercard guy. I was actually a little bit surprised that he never – I figured he'd have – you know how Hacksaw Jim Duggan was there in 80 and 81, and he had the look of a guy that might go on to become a bigger star? Frank Savage kind of had that too.
Well, he can't be that big of a star. He just did a job to Bruce Prebance.
That is not Bruce Prebance.
But anyhow, Bruce got booked in the Garden.
No, this is Neil.
The next one,
Neil Gay. Neil Gay. But
well,
Neil
let me
Gay
say this quickly about the Hangman. Even as a kid, I got a kick out of him being announced as being from Europe. He's not from a city, a state, or a country. He's from a continent.
That's how big he was.
That's none of those countries can contain the Baron. So yeah, that SD Jones versus the Baron, that must have been a masterpiece. And I actually liked SD at this point. SD, he was really good. There was like a high energy thing to him, almost like a Manny Fernandez a little bit.
Steve, what were your thoughts of SD Jones returning to the WWF? I think it was like late 1980. He'd been gone for a couple of years. To me, like you said, he looked re-energized.
Yeah, I always liked SD. I remember that year that we became a fan, 1976, he teamed with Bobo Brazil. They were the Soul Patrol. They were in the tag team tournament after the Executioners got stripped of the titles. I mean, SD was good. I feel bad that, you know, reading in recent days that, you know, Tony Atlas was not, was kind of made some mistakes in judgment, which kind of led them not to win the tag team championship, which would have been a good payday for SD. But he was a reliable guy right up until the end. I can remember him even working MSG in the early 90s for the WWF. So he's a very reliable guy, and it's just too bad he never got a big push.
You know, he was one of those guys, I don't think I'm going to back up a little bit. There's a story out there that Atlas and Jones were slated to win the WWF tag team titles.
That's what I hear.
Oh, wow. I'd never heard that one before. And it's believable because I remember, you know, when they put that tag team together, it did kind of look like they were bound to were on their way to winning the tag team titles from Fuji and Saito.
Yeah, I think Atlas may have missed some dates, and then it just kind of fell through the cracks at that point.
Very, very odd. But yeah, Tony has admitted to some lapses in judgment, and it's too bad because I see Tony Atlas as a guy who I'm not going to say he would have been the best WWF champion or the best NWA champion, but in 1981, he had me convinced that he could win either belt.
No, I agree with that completely. And I'll go as far as saying when the WWF was completely lame in the early 90s, when he was with Tony Rumble in the ICW as their kind of a fake champion, they should have brought him back at that point because the WWF was just so embarrassing in the early 90s.
It really was. And I do remember him in the ICW, and I looked at him and I'm just like, why doesn't WCW bring this guy in? I mean, they could use him, and he's certainly no worse than some of the acts that they were pushing at the time.
He seemed to be interesting as a heel because we'd never seen him like that before.
Yeah. And Tony did something. This is not WWF 1981, obviously, but Tony's number one selling point was his physique. Mm-hmm. And in 87, he's in Dallas wearing this Superman costume where you can't see the physique. I thought that was one of the more perplexing decisions by a wrestler I've ever seen.
Agreed.
We'll go on. Okay, now we get to the entertainment portion of the show. And Pedro Morales, again, making his return against Sergeant Slaughter. I will make the statement that 1981 Sergeant Slaughter might have been the best heel in wrestling.
I will not disagree. Sergeant Slaughter was riding a wave in 1981, and we're going to be talking about him a whole lot in this series. He was actually – I forgot what a good interview, what a great interview he was.
Fantastic.
Back in 80, 81. He would like bark at Vince McMahon to go get a haircut, and he was just really obnoxious in a funny way.
Oh, it was great. He was great in Mid-Atlantic. He was just – and he was fantastic. Fantastic in the ring. The guy there was no better bumping big man ever.
Agreed.
Now the December show. No, the December show was Backlund against Khan. We're talking December 80 here. That's right. Sergeant Slaughter had a match against Backlund. I want to say October of 1980 in Madison Square Garden, and that's when he got his title shot.
He faced Bruno in December, Slaughter, and Slaughter did a big blade job and got disqualified.
Yeah, did an angle where Slaughter attacked Arnold Skoland on TV, and Bruno was the guy who was coming for revenge. Backlund was in Japan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all three of us are big Slaughter fans.
Yes, especially at this time. He's fantastic. But he's a five-tool guy. And next, he invented the gimmick for him.
He had never been Sergeant Slaughter, as far as I know, before he came to the WWF with that gimmick, which was a pretty far out gimmick for 1980.
Yeah, when he debuted, and I think he was in Central States, he actually wanted to be kind of a superstar Billy Graham type heel, and that obviously didn't work for him. But he definitely made the most of this new role that he took on.
Beautiful, yeah. Bob, I mean, Remus.
You've got this big guy, and I did not think WWF emphasized enough how big he was, and who could wrestle and could talk. And they finally found the niche for him that, you know, made him a lot of money over the next 15, 20 years.
Sure.
Next up, we got Bob Backlund and against Stan Hansen. I'm incapable of disliking a Stan Hansen match.
We had one in the series that wasn't particularly good. I believe it was the third one, and I guess we'll talk about that when we get to it. But Stan Hansen was someone who, I've learned over the years what happened, was so conspicuous by his absence. He left after having the huge run against Bruno Sammartino when he broke Bruno's neck legit in 1976. And they had the Shea Stadium match with him. They had the big matches all around the circuit. And then Stan took him almost 4 years to come back. I mean, any thoughts on, you know, let me ask you guys this, or Steve, like, were you ever like, okay, when's Stan Hansen coming back? Like in 79, 80? I know I was saying that.
You know, I probably wasn't thinking that. I don't know, but Hansen definitely, I would say, after Billy Graham, after Koloff, he was the one that really stood out and shined above the rest. I mean, Patera would have to be up at the very tippy top too, but Hansen was so unbelievable. And I would say that the 1976 run against Bruno, which was that first year we were fans, and I guess that axiom about, you know, your first year as a fan is the year that really stands out. Stan Hansen was one of the greatest heels I've ever seen, you know, even to this day. And he was very good in 81 when he did come back, but definitely the chemistry with him and Backlund. And of course, I think we both know, and I'm sure Sean knows too, some of the reasons why maybe Backlund wasn't the best opponent for him. And of course, by then Hansen was already a huge star in Japan, didn't want to do jobs, but, when he was in 76, you know, he had the blonder hair, longer hair, had a more of a crazed look. He was a little more normal looking, I'd say, in 81, but he was still having some real good kick-ass brawling matches.
He always reminded me of Bobby Jaggers back then.
True.
He reminded me of Bobby Duncombe. I saw him.
That's what I meant to say. Yes, Bobby Duncombe. Yes, my mistake.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost a Duncombe clone, and Duncombe had just been there in 1975.
Mm-hmm. I just had a wonderful image of Stan Hansen as the opponent in WrestleMania 2.
That would have been a dream match for sure.
Oh, that would have been fantastic.
Would have been better than what they actually did.
Much better.
Absolutely. So we go to the main event, and Steve, the main event is Patterson, Martel, and Gurria versus the Moondogs and Captain Lou, 2 out of 3 falls. Steve,
you're
can you tell
doing
me about
this
the
on purpose. You're doing this on purpose. You know darn well that's not the main event.
Well, it's the last one listed.
The main event in why is the last match automatically the main event?
Fair enough. You know the finale. Shall we use the finale? Does that work?
Finale works.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, and Steve, I think you've been there. Like, and I'll be quick about it because I've said it before. One of the great things about the Madison Square Garden show is, okay, the show is basically over. We have this one last match that's not going to affect what the next card should be, right. And then they would announce what the next card is going to be, and they did this everywhere that had regular WWF wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, 1976, the year that we became fans, I was watching these live cards on MSG. Not on MSG, it was actually on HBO. And I actually did see the night that Hansen broke Bruno's neck, I was watching that live. And I had seen, even before that match, a card where Bruno and Monsoon teamed against the Executioners from the Nassau Coliseum, and those were great, great shows. But getting to the point, just hearing Howard Finkel announce the next month's show probably was the second most exciting thing of the night after the main event, just to hear who was coming up on next month. It was so exciting.
It really was. And, you know, I've said this before. I mean, we would go to the Boston Garden and see wrestling. It was like probably a 40-minute trip home, and we probably spent more time talking about the next show and how excited we were about that than talking about what we had just seen at the Boston Garden.
Very true.
But yeah,
you were just looking for a reason to get.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just joking. I was saying you were just looking for a reason to get that spiel in. I just wanted to ask you guys, what do you think about the Martel Garea Moondog feud? Steve, what do you think?
I hated the Moondogs. I just thought that they were like really kind of tacky and low rent and very lacking in, you know, real wrestling ability. I know they were brawling guys. And I mean, the most memorable thing about their stay in the WWF was the one guy, King, kind of, I guess, got deported or something or sent to Canada.
Yeah.
And Lou Albano, Brian Last would say, you know, he started to morph into his proteges. He started to let his hair get gray, and he wear like crazier outfits. But he actually, Captain Lou actually did a lot of wrestling in six man tags like this match all around the circuit. And when King, we lost King for a while, he teamed up, Albano teamed up with Rex in a lot of the smaller towns in the circuit. So at least it gave Captain Lou a chance to get out and show some great wrestling.
I am with you, Steve. I did not like the Moondogs one bit. I just thought the whole thing was embarrassing. It was not even cartoonish. It was sophomoric. Just did not like it at all. It's embarrassing enough when people find out that you are, to me at least, it was embarrassing enough sometimes to be a wrestling fan when you didn't have stuff like the Moondogs. And 81, I mean, talk about Geek Fest. We had Killer Khan, George Steele, and the Moondogs. Mm-hmm. And it was just all stuff I didn't like.
Wasn't one of the Moondogs repackaged as Demolition years later and everyone recognized them?
That's right. That was Randy Cully, who was Rex. And it didn't work. And they brought in Smash. What's his name there?
Crusher Khrushchev.
Right, that's right.
So how about Martel and Garea? Did Rick do the impossible and make Tony watchable?
He did the impossible by near impossible by getting into a good tag team with Tony Garea. I personally feel that Rick Martel is one of the most underrated wrestlers out there. I didn't think he got a big enough push during this run. I thought, you know, he was a great tag team partner for Garea. I thought they meshed together well. They looked very natural together. But yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of difficult to have Tony in an interesting and good tag team, but Martel pulled it off.
Steve, what did you think about him?
No, they were perfect for the time. And you got to remember, and I think John has said this before, the WWF audience at that time were really not very discriminating. I mean, the following year is when we got to see Mighty Joe Thunder. And I mean, when Mighty Joe Thunder was in the ring, the fans were so quiet and patient and, very receptive to anything. They didn't boo. They didn't scream. So Martel and Garea compared to Mighty Joe Thunder, they were like world-class Olympians.
And let's be honest, the girls like the Martel Garea team.
Right.
As we roll through at our usual pace, we've just made it through our first card at the 40-minute mark.
I'm surprised we made it to the second card. I'm not even joking.
I was determined. It was happening.
All right.
So we go to March 16th, 1981. Crowd. I have a crowd here of 21,000 plus. This is also MSG card. Okay, I have Yatsus, the Baron. I have Jones, Rods, Moondog Rex against Rick McGraw. There's nothing watchable yet. Danucci and Larry Sharp. I guess.
That's like a classic WWF match by two guys who'd been there forever. I would have loved seeing those two at a high school gym.
Well, after seeing the Baron, yeah, it must have been an upgrade.
who'd Cicluna wrestle?
Well, it's Yatsu, so that's kind of cool.
All right. Cicluna had been in the WWF since I first started watching in 76. And when, you know, the internet finally became a thing and I could look up how long he had been there, Cicluna had been there kind of nonstop since like 66 or 67.
And you looked every year of it.
Oh, by this point, yes. And it would go downhill quickly by 83.
Now that we're having our Baron Cicluna moment in the sun, I wanted to share these two little quick things. Baron Cicluna actually beat Kurt Hennig, who was debuting this year in a few different house shows around the circuit. So it shows that Kurt Hennig really started from the ground up. And also, you're going to love this house show result. In June of 1981 in Wheeling, West Virginia, Bruno Sammartino was supposed to take on Killer Khan, but Killer Khan no-showed, and he was replaced by Baron Mikel Cicluna. So Baron and Bruno had one final match in 1981 in Wheeling, West Virginia.
That is totally awesome. Wheeling's not that far from Pittsburgh either, so you could, if you wanted to make the trip.
A dream match.
You know what? That might have been... I think that match is so crazy, I would have loved to have seen it.
Well, I know they actually wrestled each other on TV in the mid-70s in the WWF, I think in 75. And Kevin Sullivan has said after Bruno's passing that they put on an unbelievable match, the two of them, just like a nonstop action, nonstop motion. Because, you know, for all his demerits, Baron Cicluna always was in great shape. And, you know, he could definitely... move very quickly, and of course Bruno was always in great shape, so they actually enjoy working with each other.
And I've always heard, and this should come to no surprise to anyone, that Baron was particularly well liked by the other wrestlers and by the guys in the office, and that could go a long way.
Right.
I mean, they kept him around for almost 20 years, and by the time he retired, I mean, there was just no way they could have kept him around for another day. He just looked too old.
Right.
John does this on purpose. Whenever I pick on somebody, he brings up all his wonderful personal qualities. So I end up feeling bad about it later.
I always bring up everyone's wonderful personal qualities. I'm like that.
Right, yeah, particularly right after I just made fun of him. We have Dom DiNucci and Larry Sharp. What do you guys remember about Larry Sharp? What do you remember about him, Steve?
Larry Sharp and Jack Evans were kind of a low-level tag team in the WWF. And, of course, as everybody knows, Larry Sharp eventually became Bam Bam Bigelow's manager in the Monster Factory. And, of course, the infamous appearances on the Morton Downey Jr. show. But I mainly remember that tag team with Evans and Sharp. They were kind of good underneath guys in the old WWF.
Jack Evans was very good in the 70s, especially the mid-early. He has one little tag team curtain jerker match out there. I think it was in 75. Mm-hmm. And it was like full undercard guy. It was fantastic. You could see the crowd starting to pick up steam. Like, what's going on? What's this?
They were good. They were very underrated. Very underrated, yeah. Sean. You're absolutely right.
Hey, Sean, could you ask me what my favorite Larry Sharp moment was?
You were next on the list.
We went out. We were in New Jersey. We went to one of Dennis Caruso's shows, and we went out for breakfast the next day. There were like six or seven of us, and Larry tried to dine and dash on us and stick us with his end of the bill. I loved Larry anyway, though. I don't care. He was a good guy. He's a funny guy. He's missed.
Yeah.
He was good for this role. He had been around for a while. You knew he was just kind of a part-time guy. He wasn't going to drive far from South Jersey where he lived, but he was a regular on the Spectrum and MSG shows. Sometimes would appear on TV, I mean, sporadically, but you knew you were looking at a guy who was a good mid-card wrestler.
Okay. Yep. No, I like Larry. They had a lot of really good undercard guys at that point, like somewhere in like the early 70s. A lot of it was him, Johnny Rods, Larry Evans. They get a bad rap as far as what became of it in the 80s. Hanson gets a
Evans,
cut.
right around this time, Jack Evans, I don't know if he was there yet or he was about to be there, but he wrestled under a hood as the Black Demon.
Mm. Oh, noted. Did Stan Hansen get a victory over Backlund here?
If this is match number two, it would make sense that he did, because I know they did a three match series.
Yeah, I didn't remember seeing it. Well, how often did they go over the count out loss over Backlund for two? I know they did it often with Bruno.
It was only the real top guys like Valentine, like Morocco, and like Stan Hansen.
I happened to see this match the other day on YouTube, and basically they were kind of like dead even as far as the match, and Backlund was just kind of on the apron, and Hansen just hit him with a standing lariat, not a running lariat, but just knocked him down off the apron, and he got counted out, and it definitely got the fans ready for the final third and final encounter.
Steve, let me ask you my memory's a little bit fuzzy on this. Did they do an angle where Hansen like beat up Bob Backlund on TV? Did they do anything to like hype up this match besides just it's Stan Hansen, he's a really big star?
I think they did one of those typical things where Hansen was probably beating up one of the prelim guys after a squash match, and he just was not, relenting and just kept pushing and pushing, and then all of a sudden Backlund runs in street clothes and Hansen, lays him out. Didn't knock him out, but just like, run roughshod over him. And then, Hansen and Blassie left for higher ground. So it definitely, made the feud more of a hotter item.
Yeah, I think he was wrestling Rick McGraw on Championship Wrestling, and that mm-hmm. happened. Exactly what you said. Hansen's just mm-hmm. beating the crap out of McGraw. Backlund runs in, and Hansen, gets the best of the early part of the brawl. When Backlund starts to make a comeback, Hansen bails.
Right.
If I recall correctly. It's been a while.
That's what I seem to recall as well.
All right. But, yeah, we were looking forward to Hansen coming back and for a long time, and here he was. That was me. I was always wondering about what was going to happen next. And I was always wondering, when guys like Stan Hansen were going to come back. And finally, he was back, and I was really glad to see him.
No, I agree with that. I think just as a fan hoping to see Backlund get beat, I was getting discouraged because he had beaten such high quality challengers. After a while, you just you begin to worry: is Backlund going to be around for 100 years?
I thought I had it figured out. Morales had the belt for 3 years. Bruno had the belt for 3 years. Now, right around this time, Bob Backlund has had the belt for 3 years. And I'm kind of thinking, okay, maybe it's time for a change. I mean, I didn't know anything about, Bob Backlund being a draw and how well he was doing. I just figured you threw whoever out there and people would come to see them. But one thing, preparing for the show, I wanted to mention this. In 1980, they had the Bruno Sammartino versus Larry Zbyszko feud. And the WWF on Saturdays were working two shows every night. Not every night, every Saturday night. And they would both shows would be like, Bruno in the main event in one, Backlund in the main event in the other. Then they would have two more competitive matches. And from there, it would be like all squash guys matched up against each other. And it was a license to print money. They drew. And if you're drawing $100,000 house twice a week, you're doing well. And they maintained this coming into 1981.
Pedro, I have a complaint here. We have Pedro Morales, who I believe at this point is the Intercontinental Champion. Am I correct?
Right.
He is.
Okay. Pedro Morales defending against Moondog King. This was a thing they did back then, which is annoying. They would take whatever one of their better heel tag team is and split them up for title matches, knowing they weren't going to win.
You're right, Sean. That was pretty annoying. It really was.
It didn't. I never felt annoyed by that, and I'll tell you why. Because it was just what I was used to. I didn't know any better. No one thinks that one of the Moondogs is going to win the Intercontinental title. But I mean, the year before they had the Samoans against Bob Backlund in singles matches for the world championship. Granted, Zbyszko and Bruno was the real main event, but I mean, it's all what you're used to, and we were used to seeing the tag team guys in singles matches.
Like all shenanigans in the whole thing. Next up, now here's a great match. Andre, when you could still move a little bit, again, in there with the Sarge. That's fantastic. I mean, how did they play that up any?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Slaughter was great on the interviews, calling Andre the French frog and how he's going to put him in a box and send him back to France and stuff like that. This was Slaughter at his peak.
And I think it's worthwhile to say that I would go as far as saying that 1981 was Backlund's last great year, because in 1982, I think Snuka started to steal some of Backlund's thunder. And to your point, Sean and John, I think this was Andre's last great year too, because the injury he sustained, I don't know if he fell out of bed or whatever happened to him, but the matches with Killer Khan, which we're eventually going to get to, were definitely one of the highlights of Andre's WWF run.
I agree.
We should just to state, that was the famous angle with Khan and Andre, where, you know, obviously Andre broke his leg someplace else, but they blamed it on Killer Khan, and it turned into a series of stretcher matches.
That's right.
Now, think about Sergeant Slaughter. He has been in the wrestling business, I want to say, 5 years. You know, it was a little bit of a struggle. He did okay mid-card under a mask in the AWA. He'd been working Central States. He comes into the WWF. They give him this crazy good gimmick where he's the deranged, ex-Marine. And he comes in and he wrestles Backlund, then he wrestles Bruno, then he wrestles Pedro Morales, and then he wrestles Andre the Giant. I mean, this guy's got to be walking on air at this point.
He was making some good money, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and one of these things, like, you know, whatever his name is, Bob Remus, had to go home at night and just look in the mirror and smile and said, "Man, I've made it." And he didn't, and he had.
Yeah, and he earned it too. He, like Sean said earlier, there was nobody better at taking bumps, especially for a big guy his size.
No, I thought he was phenomenal. And when they first rolled him out there, I believe it was the Saturday after the Shea Stadium show in 1980. I mean, I was enough of a fan. I was a avid reader of the magazines, and I was just like, you know, I knew there was no such guy as Sergeant Slaughter, or at least that's the way I saw it. And for a guy I looked at and said, okay, they just made someone up. I didn't even recognize his face. And you know, that, oh my God, they made him up thing, I got over that quickly. I accepted him as a top guy.
Yeah, he was, definitely.
Okay, we have another tag team split and another point for me to complain. The first one seems fine. And again, I don't recall the Hangman, but I'll take Steve's word for it. And he's in there with Martel, who's fantastic at this point, so that's fine. You want to give them 15 minutes, that's fine. Next, we have Tony Garea against Bulldog Brower. Why don't you just pull the fire alarm? If you want him out that bad. I mean, 11 minutes to these two? Are you that must have been like a top 10 worst match ever.
You know, Sean, what's funny about you saying that is this is March of 1981. I know on the December 1979 card, Larry Zbyszko, getting ready for his feud with Bruno, beat Bulldog Brower. And when Vince was doing commentary on that match, he trashed Bulldog Brower and just said, "Look at this guy, you know, his conditioning is terrible." You know, and he was just all over Bulldog Brower, looking like way over the hill at that point. So here we are 2 years later. I think you're right, Sean. I think he was just, just kind of going through the motions.
What did Brower have on people? I don't get it. I mean, I know he's the king of North Attleboro because he seemed to be in the main event there every other month. But, I mean, what did he have? I don't get it. I mean, he didn't even look good. I mean, I understand you had a little leeway about your appearance, but he went way beyond that at this point.
All I can imagine is maybe is he did a lot of big business in the 60s, so maybe they were just grateful for the business he brought in back in the old days, and they were just kind of throwing him a bone because maybe he needed the money.
Then they should have built a palace to Bill Watts. have to roll this guy out all the time. I mean, that's just horrible. But now the next match makes up for it.
Well, you know, Tony, what? Can I say something about the Hangman really quick?
Oh,
he's someone that they brought in 1980, and Fred Blassie was his manager. And he looked like a guy, maybe, just maybe, they could get away with having one match in Madison Square Garden against Bob Backlund. He would have been a really weak challenger, but I think they could have gotten away with it. And he turned into one of those, like, Torquemada, Iron Mike Sharp heels where he never got that big a push. And the first time you saw him on TV and Fred Blassie was gone, was not no longer with him, like, you knew he was just getting that mid-card push. As far as Brower goes, I never understood it. Brower was one of the – you're not going to believe this. Brower helped me get hooked on wrestling because the first wrestling show I ever saw on TV, he attacked Johnny Powers with a chair, and my mind was blown. You know, no one in boxing or baseball did anything like that ever. But when he came to the WWF in 79, even as like a 13-year-old kid, I was like, what is this? This guy, you know, he's old, he's fat, he's out of shape, and I don't understand. And he had been out of the business for a while, at least as far as I know. I don't know what he was doing in 77 or 78. So it was crazy. It made no sense. But I do know that he lived in Delaware legit. Maybe they just needed a body to drive up to New York and do a job for Gurria. I'm assuming he did a job for Gurria.
You would hope so. Did you ever get to see him live, John?
I did not get to see him live ever. No, I did not.
I got to see Brower against Backlund, actually. And I think at the time, Brower's finisher was kind of like a bulldog type move. And, you know, I guess I hated Backlund so much I even wanted Bulldog Brower to win the title. But again, I was foiled. So.
Okay, I did not hate Bob Backlund that much. I did not go that over the top.
Well, let me say though, even at the time, even though I hated Bob Backlund, I did respect him because he was definitely somebody who you talk about the respect for professional wrestling. You could always look at Bob Backlund and be proud that he represented professional wrestling so well, and he's a great guy. But as a fan, nah, I was always rooting for the heels.
No, I saw Bob as being uncool.
I will give Bob this. Bob never half-assed a match. You're getting an effort out of Bob each time. I agree with John there. You can't have that act every day.
Right.
By the time I saw it, I didn't really start watching day to day until like the end of 92, early 90, 82, early 83. And it was just off by that point.
Right.
Yeah, Bob's best days were behind him at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we are kind of running up toward the end right now. I believe we're running out of time at the moment.
Was Gurria against Bulldog Brower the final match?
No, it was Tony Atlas against Hulk Hogan, and with Atlas going over Hogan.
Okay. Now, they did an angle, and this is the last match, right?
Yes.
Okay. They did an angle to build up this feud where Tony Atlas, I believe Hulk Hogan was mouthing off on TV, and Tony Atlas came out and challenged him, and they had a brief brawl in the ring that ended when Hulk Hogan like kind of brought him up, Atlas up for a back suplex, but instead crotched him on the ropes. And I just remember watching this with my friends and thinking that was like such a cheap, dirty thing to do. But that's what got the feud rolling.
And that kind of tells you what they thought of Tony at that point, Steve. They're putting him over Hulk. I know Hulk was leaving, but still.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely had big plans for Tony Atlas then. But as we all know, within a couple of years, that was all by the wayside.
Well, Tony had debuted, I want to say, like September or October of 1979. And you know, this run was it nearing its end? Did Tony like kind of take, oh, that's right. Tony kind of disappeared for a little while in 1980 and came back in late 1980. he was gone for a little while. I do know that they freshened him up, and this was the beginning of a nice push for him.
Is this when he went to Georgia with Kevin Sullivan?
That was early 1980 that he was in Georgia. So yeah, okay. That's the break he took from the WWF. He was here a little while, like late 79, early 80. Then he split, and then he came back, I want to say like November, December of 1980. So yeah, and what was the result of Hogan and Atlas, Sean?
Tony goes over at 7:08. That's why I was so impressed by it. They must really think a lot of Tony at that point.
Yeah, and like you said, Hogan was on his way out, and he had been there for a while. But you know what? I'm going to give this show a new tagline, the fastest 60 minutes out there, because it always goes by so quick, and I always want to hang out some more, but we keep it at 60. Steve, thank you very much for coming on, man. I thought you were great.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great to be on the show, and thank you both for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And Sean, thank you for all of you do. I sincerely mean that. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. It has been produced by our good friend Lou Kippelman. And Lou, thank you very much. We will see you all next week.